Hello, this week's Bruin podcast is with me, Guy Foster, head of research at Bruin Dolphin, speaking to Tom Derry, chief executive of the Institute of Supply Management, which runs one of the longest running, certainly the most influential survey of businesses in the world. It's not intended as investment advice. The data which Tom and his organization get is one of the very best real-time indicators of how corporates are finding the operating environment. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, the ISM survey gives a good indication of how the economy is performing. But when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations. And future performance can differ from that of the past. So with those warnings duly issued, now let's get on with the podcast. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest Bruin podcast. My name's Guy Foster, head of research here at Bruin Dolphin. And in this podcast, we're delighted we're going to be joined by Tom Derry, who is the chief executive of the Institute of Supply Management. So, Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Really, really pleased to have you on. Just for our listeners, I wonder if you could just explain, you know, what the ISM is and the kind of insights that you get into the workings of business in the States.
Yeah, thank you, Guy, very much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be able to talk about ISM's work and hopefully provide some useful information to your audience and your listeners. The Institute for Supply Management was founded in 1915 in New York, so we're the world's oldest organization. We're a professional body, ultimately, for supply management professionals, primarily in the United States, but we are a global organization with a particularly significant presence in China and Southeast Asia, in addition to the US. And among the many things that we do, we publish some widely followed research on a monthly basis that looks at a number of detailed factors about the performance of global supply chains. And it turns out that the insights that come from that particular work are highly correlated to movements of GDP in the United States and some other interesting macroeconomic conditions like inflation and so forth. And we've got more than 80 years of history in the manufacturing sector to support that and more than 30 years of history in the services sector of the economy. So we've built up a loyal following, if you will, of not just business practitioners who are looking to fine-tune their supply strategies, but also the investment community who looks at the data. The data does move markets here in the United States. Policymakers, including at the White House and the Federal Reserve Board, who are very interested in the implications of the movement from month to month, which is what we're measuring and capturing. And as far as the economic data is concerned, we're the closest thing to a real-time indicator of how the U.S. economy is performing. I can get into some of those details a little bit. In addition, of course, we published research on factors that are emerging in the supply management context, whether it was, you know, Brexit back in 2016, and certainly the impact of COVID-19 today, and the U.S.-China trade war is something we've been reporting data on. So we're very fortunate to have a perspective on these issues because we're dealing with people in the trenches, people who literally sit at the intersection of supply and demand on behalf of their companies. They're trying to satisfy the demand downstream for their customers. They're also responsible for generating the upstream demand they create for their suppliers. So they, better than any other corporate function, they really are very sensitive to fine adjustments in the conditions of supply and demand. And it turns out this data is very useful in understanding some, you know, interesting questions for all of us.
That's great. And so I think probably for our listeners, just to emphasize that you mentioned it, the closest thing to a real-time indicator for a lot of these variables. I mean, obviously things like GDP and CPI, measures of some key economic factors, are typically quite lagged, whereas these surveys come out in a really, really timely way. So why don't I ask you, what have been the major issues then that the businesses that you've been surveying have had to face? If you had to sort of give the top 1, 2, 3, whatever the appropriate number happens to be, what are the main issues that businesses have been facing recently?
Well, clearly at the current moment, although we're coming out of the most intense period, there was this supply disruption crisis that was related to the emergence of the global pandemic. And as we all know, with China being the world's second largest economy and a major export economy at that, export-driven economy, when it went into its own protective lockdown in late January and into February, that had major repercussions for firms all around the world, and including the United States. And so we can talk about that. I also want to talk about, interestingly, it is interrelated with and affected by the ongoing trade war between the United States and China. So maybe I'll begin by setting the context there and then moving into the pandemic. For most of 2019, based on our own data, most supply management practitioners in the US were very concerned about the implications of the imposition of tariffs by the United States and the retaliatory tariffs that were imposed by China. And there are a number of strategies that companies can typically employ to deal with tariffs. And it was quite interesting to note that initially the reaction by US firms was mostly one of, "This looks to be temporary. We think it will be settled. We think that the administration's position was," I mean, this was a judgment that came through in our data, was one largely about forcing the Chinese government to the negotiating table. And they'd be successful in that, and then the tariffs would be behind us, because the view is, we've long since established that tariffs only do economic damage, in trade relations between countries. They don't actually help in any way. But as the dispute was prolonged, it was clear that companies began to think, well, this is not really temporary. This is not something that we can sort of share the pain with our suppliers, and we'll both agree to take, a 5% hit on a 10% tariff. And it's going to be longer term than that, it appears, and we need to really begin to adjust seriously to the prospect. And then, of course, later in the year, the administration announced the threat of moving to 25% tariff levels, which would have been cataclysmic, really, for many companies, because many industries don't operate at anything near a 25% profit margin. So 25% tariffs could have all but eaten all of the profit making opportunity that existed. And so you began to see a real change in behavior. In particular, you saw a lot of buying ahead of inventory, which would be a natural reaction, right? You wanted to buy ahead, really, for two reasons. One, to avoid buying inventory potentially at a 25% tariff level. And secondly, anticipating the Chinese New Year, which is a well-known phenomenon and planned for every year, there's typically a hiatus of production during the Chinese New Year, and so you were buying ahead to build a little buffer stock, anticipating the new year. And as a consequence, we actually were a slightly better position than we might otherwise have been when the pandemic emerged. We actually had a little more inventory on hand than we typically would like to carry. And that carried us through the initial period of disruption pretty well. But we knew right away that there was going to be a period of time, somewhere beginning in late March or April and running for anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks, where that excess inventory would have been consumed in the normal course of business. And it was becoming very difficult to replenish supply. Our own data indicated that lead times, which is, the amount of time it typically takes for an order to be fulfilled and to receive the goods or services, had doubled coming out of China. So if it had been a 4-week lead time or an 8-week lead time, it was now 8 or 16 weeks, respectively. And that was just on the production end. We also had this massive transportation imbalance because of the pandemic outbreak. So we had no production effectively coming out of China for a period of time. Therefore, container ships were not moving across the Pacific. They were sitting empty in Chinese ports. We did not have labor in Chinese ports, so we couldn't sort of decongest the ports. And we canceled all of the passenger flights between, the United States and China, among other countries. And most people fail to appreciate how much industrial goods move in the cargo holds of those passenger planes. And so we basically had no air freight or no ocean freight available, even if we could get our orders filled in a timely way. So we had this significant disruption in supply that is playing out here in the United States, at least, in very noticeable ways. Consumers are complaining about a lack of cleaning supplies and disinfectants on store shelves, or they're seeing unusual brands creep into stores because the big familiar names and companies aren't able to produce at levels in accordance with a surge in demand. And so small, heretofore unknown companies are creeping in to help try to meet that demand. And so we're seeing a significant kind of reconfiguration of marketplace conditions here in the U.S. as a result of that. So that's ongoing, although the effects are moderating a little bit. The lead times are no longer operating at double their normal performance, but they are operating at somewhere between 70 and 80% of performance still. And production is returning to normal in China, but is not fully back to what you would expect even today, although it has significantly improved. So there are these significant changes in the United States. As the United States reacted to the pandemic, we went into our own voluntary lockdown conditions as well, like many countries did. And I don't mean to be facetious, but I refer to this as a medically induced coma for the U.S. economy. We went into, the data has been reported, we had a 32 to 33% year-over-year contraction in U.S. GDP for the second quarter. That was the preliminary number coming out of the U.S. government a few weeks back. So staggering number and very significant contraction. And so what began as a supply disruption quickly became an issue really of aggregate demand in the economy. And I think that's what is the more persistent issue going forward, is consumer confidence has to return. Consumer buying behavior has to return to something approaching normal levels before we really, even though conditions have improved and our own economic data shows that we've moved out of about a 2-month period of contraction in April and May into growth mode again, expansion mode across all industries, it's still not as robust as it might have been. The hope for V-shaped recovery is probably not as robust as it could have been without a return to sort of normal consumer behavior in the US.
And so, I mean, obviously one of the main things that's going to impact that aggregate demand position is employment. And I think the forecasting community is having tremendous difficulty ascertaining what the employment numbers are going to be from 1 month to the next, or 1 week to the next, I suppose. What are you hearing from your respondents in terms of what their plans might be regarding employment?
Yeah, they do. One of the data points that we specifically collect. And generally speaking, it's a positive outlook. So employment is expanding again in the United States. We have an interesting policy dilemma. Part of the legislative response to the pandemic was the provision of additional supplemental unemployment benefits from the federal level. Normally, unemployment benefits in the United States are paid by the states to, unemployed workers in those locations, those jurisdictions. But there was a supplemental provision of an additional $600 worth of unemployment insurance to affected individuals, which, has had, I think, a hoped for stimulating effect on consumer spend. But it had a paradoxical effect, we're hearing, that it's discouraged workers who are frankly doing better with the supplemental pay than they were doing in the jobs that they held before they became unemployed. So particularly in lower paying jobs in the hospitality sector, in construction, in restaurants, people were discouraged from returning to work. And so we were hearing firms reporting that they were having trouble bringing people back, even those that were not necessarily laid off, but merely furloughed. So that's had a dampening effect, but otherwise we have seen an improvement in employment across most industry sectors, and that does bode well for consumer spending. We are also having a debate in this country right now about whether it is safe to reopen elementary and secondary education, even higher education here in the United States. And the teachers seem to have taken one point of view about considering that it's safe for teachers themselves and faculty and staff, in addition to the students. And there's not a consensus yet about the safety of opening schools. And that has a major stimulative effect typically in this time of year in the U.S. economy. So that's been delayed and postponed. And a lot of education is happening still in an online context for families with, school-aged children. So that's another kind of countercurrent that we have to navigate here in the United States.
So what's that stimulative effect is what, sort of the back to school getting stationary or something? Sorry, I don't mean to. I'm just trying to understand.
That's exactly it. It's spending across the board on technology, computers and laptops and so forth, clothing. It's broad based, and it's a seasonal factor that we account for in forecasting US GDP.
And I just want to bring you back to just to clarify something that you said a few moments ago then about what you're hearing from companies, that you genuinely heard from companies that they were struggling to get employees back to work because of the generosity of the enhanced employment benefits.
That's correct. And that was true in many different industries. I mentioned a few, construction, yeah, restaurant business. We've just seen an issuance by executive order by the United States president, a continuation, yeah, at a lower level of the same supplemental unemployment benefit. So it could be a persistent factor.
Okay. So so it would be interesting. I guess we'll just have to wait and see whether the reduction that we've seen in the size of those benefits is sufficient to tempt more people back into their jobs, or whether it needs to be cut further. And I mean, I only major on this because it's obviously been such a bitter kind of political dispute what level those extra benefits should be. So obviously the insight you're getting there is really very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah. So talking about trade, and you mentioned, I mean, obviously the general consensus view there on tariffs, which is that that they're negative, they don't help economically. But obviously there are winners and losers. So, I mean, when you're kind of representing the views of respondents, presumably there is some cohort that has been benefiting or expects to be able to benefit from the imposition of these tariffs with China. Is it, is it just a very small cohort, or is it that it will take time to adapt to the tariffs? I mean, what's the situation with the winners from this policy?
Oh, I think in terms of benefit, and this would probably be more in the medium term, not the short term, but there are a couple of clear trends that we pick up in our data. First of all, there's been movement of sources of supply to non-tariff subject countries. And that is driven, interestingly, I think, by two factors. One is, large corporations who have significant sourcing activity in China, for instance, are clearly asking their suppliers to stand up new facilities in tariff-exempt countries. So that's one source of it. But there's also quite an interesting movement that comes from private companies in China themselves, who literally have been exporting Chinese management teams from China to countries like Vietnam to stand up new sources of supply in, for instance, that country under Chinese management, because they view the ongoing trade war, is negatively impacting their business themselves. So it's not simply U.S. generated demand for broadening supply bases, but business people in China are clearly coming to that conclusion on their own. So one other interesting area that I would look to that potentially is healthy, as we all know, the question around telecommunications interdependencies between the United States and China and other countries, including the UK and Europe in general, Huawei and companies like that, that's been a significant political debate and an issue for well over a year now. The movement of suppliers to some of these third countries potentially could relieve some of the strategic vulnerability. We have an overconcentration of semiconductor fabrication, for instance, in Taiwan and China. And semiconductors are a specific target of China's Made in China 2025 policy. So, moving up the value chain in manufacturing. So there could be, to the extent there is dispersal of these supply networks more broadly, and I don't want to overstate that, because China has got ample engineering talent. They have well-developed, sophisticated infrastructure for the movement of goods. They've got critical clusters of supply networks in places like Shenzhen and along the east coast of China. So that it's not going to go away completely, but it may be moderated to a certain extent. And then when you factor in the effect of the pandemic, it's clearly on the mind of many national governments that we've become over-reliant in medical supply chains on China as a source of active pharmaceutical ingredients that go into medicines and drugs, of electronic components that go into medical devices, and even low value add manufacturing, but critical items of personal protective equipment like face shields and latex gloves and masks. And so there's clearly, in the United States, it's already been stated, but there's serious consideration of either incentivizing or perhaps even mandating some restarting of a de minimis level of supply chain for medical product here in the United States to protect us against a strategic vulnerability, you know, if there is another pandemic that we're dealing with, and maybe the interests of countries don't necessarily align on the free movement of critical product across national boundaries in a time like that. So, you know, there are some interesting changes coming, I think, in some critical industries.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you're using the examples of these sort of strategically important industries from that perspective. I mean, I guess when I was thinking about winners, I suppose I was expecting that there might be more domestic US winners, that there might be more supply chain, you know, for perfectly sort of private profit orientated private sector type motivations, there might be more of an incentive to try and bring supply chains back to the United States. It's a trend that I remember reading about probably 5 years ago when gas prices were collapsing, and that this was going to drive much cheaper, much more competitive American manufacturing, and that we're going to see a big sort of reshoring or onshoring of production coming from that. So is that a trend that doesn't exist? Is it something that is happening? Is it something that could be accelerated by the complications of supply chain management with both the trade war and COVID at the moment?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a skeptic when it comes to the prospect for reshoring, as we use that term here in the United States, meaning, you know, bringing manufacturing literally back to the domestic U.S. But I have seen and continue to see more nearshoring. In particular, northern Mexico has become, in certain sectors, aerospace and defense and automotive being two of the biggest. They have a well-developed advanced manufacturing environment. There's proximity to the North American end user or customer, high quality education, relatively low labor costs. So, you know, some geographic areas are benefiting from this tension, and we're seeing that happen. I certainly know that U.S. companies are looking to no longer source, a select few of U.S. companies are no longer planning to source from China because of what they perceive to be geopolitical instability, and are looking to find some replacement suppliers in places like northern Mexico. In terms of certain industries, one that clearly benefited from the outbreak of the pandemic, and there are always winners and losers, you're right, Guy, was the telecommunications industry, not just in the United States, but worldwide. A surge in demand for all of the devices and services that keep us connected, right? Like the laptop I'm speaking to you from, and the Microsoft Teams meeting that we're in. So when you have to support education from home, support work from home, large companies like Cox in the United States, TELUS in Canada, Charter Telecommunications in the U.S., and it's a global phenomenon. They were seeing a surge in demand and, you know, frankly, having a hard time keeping up. The electronic components industry had a hard time kind of meeting production requirements for the surge in command. So there's definitely some lag time there, but they're clearly one of the big winners. Another big winner has been packaged foods companies. People are, you know, stocking their pantries and keeping on hand, you know, not just sort of a week supply of food product, but, you know, weeks and weeks in some cases. And so when a surge in demand, I mean, just to be a little facetious for a moment, PepsiCo, large food and beverage company here in the United States, has seen a surge in demand for its macaroni and cheese, its pre-made macaroni and cheese product, and has announced that it's going to come out with a series of new flavors to meet consumer demand for this this food item. And I find that interesting. And I also find it to be probably a mistake, because the overall trend has been skew simplification as companies have tried to deal with, you know, a surge in demand and increasing production. And I think skew proliferation, more flavors of the same food product in this case, is probably not going to be, I would guess this is not a permanent change in consumer demand, that it's temporary, returned back to historical norms in terms of consumer consumption patterns, and that an investment in, you know, might be ill-timed in trying to capture some of this temporary demand is the way I would perceive it.
So I want to ask you just a very topical one. I mean, I might draw a blank on this, one of the other executive orders that the president signed recently has been this one related to WeChat. The investment community is scrambling to understand the implications, generally feeling that it isn't a very significant for US businesses. But I mean, we're aware that WeChat is so ubiquitous in China as a means of communicating and also as an instrument of commerce, that we have heard some stories that actually it's going to make it difficult for some US companies that might have communicated with their Chinese suppliers by WeChat. I wondered if you'd heard any such thing from your respondents.
Well, I'm not at all surprised, because even ISM uses WeChat as a critical communication channel for our business in China. And I do think that's a little misdirected. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know, TikTok obviously has been in the news and somewhat controversial policy around that particular company and that service. It seems to me that WeChat is so integral to the conduct of business in China and with Chinese business partners outside of China. We use it in Arizona to communicate with our business partners in China. It seems misdirected in terms of policy to target WeChat as anything of presenting some kind of a strategic threat to the United States. I mean, if you want to simply say we're trying to thwart the rise of Chinese internet giants, technology giants, and therefore WeChat is a target because that's our policy, well, I would argue whether that's I would say that's not a wise policy. But you might justify targeting WeChat on that basis. But in terms of it posing a security threat or you know, challenging U.S. predominance in terms of next horizon technology, I think it's misdirected. I don't think that's I think that's a mistake.
Okay. Well, look, that's very useful. I know we're kind of running out of time, so if I just ask you one last question then, and it's really to bring you back, I guess, to something we were talking about right at the beginning of the call. Now, if you're a company in the US, you're facing supply challenges coming from the trade war, supply challenges coming from COVID. You've got this uncertain outlook for demand. Now, what approach do the companies take now to deciding how much inventory they want to carry, given that they have both uncertainties in terms of the demand and supply?
Yeah, it is a conundrum, absolutely. So our data shows that 36% of firms in the United States are intentionally carrying more inventory than they normally would, given the circumstances. By the way, that same research also shows that firms report that demand has dropped on average about 15% for their businesses in the United States. So you're carrying more inventory in the face of declining demand, which you would think would not ordinarily be how firms would want to be managing their business. But they're very concerned about the disruption of supply. They are anticipating a return to normal conditions, although it appears the consensus in the United States for the U.S. point of view is that this was not going to be a short duration event now of a couple of months. It's maybe going to take us longer to get through this than we anticipated. So the companies nonetheless are anticipating a return to more normal conditions, and they don't want to be caught in a position where they can't meet that, you know, returning sort of demand profile. So that's the, I think that explains the paradox. Demand clearly has declined right now, but we're anticipating growth and return to normal levels of demand. And so we want to be in a position to respond to that and not miss out.
Okay. All right. Well, Tom, thank you so much. I think that's been, it's been really interesting to get your insights on all of these topics. Really appreciate your time on that. So thanks to you. And thanks also to all of our listeners for joining us for this edition. Hopefully you found it useful, and hopefully you'll join us again next time on another Brewing Podcast.